This is the first time I've spoken with the red clock up there, and it is actually intimidating, to be honest with you. We're going to turn to Matthew 24, and I'm going to read a substantial part of that passage. It's actually kind of hard to cut out some of that, any of that chapter, but I'll cut it a little bit short at least. Matthew 24. Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples. I'm sorry, what am I doing? That's 23. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming, and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall arise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say to you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. And I'm going to end the reading there. Matthew 24 is, of course, the well-known chapter spoken by the Lord about end times. It contains the great tribulation, contains wars and rumors of wars, false prophets, lying signs and wonders, and of course the climax of the return of King Jesus. In addition to end times, the passages also have a more immediate context for the disciples which it was spoken to, specifically related to the destruction of Jerusalem in year 70 AD. It's beyond the scope of this scope or the topic to discuss in this message the dividing between the passages, which referred to the destruction of Jerusalem, which referred to the end of the world. My opinion personally is that some of the passages are exclusively for the destruction of Jerusalem, and some are obviously exclusively for the end of the world. But I'm convinced personally that a great deal of the passages have a double fulfillment or at least a double application in both of those, for both of those events. I also want to preface the message by saying that I'm not going to try to pinpoint where our current time period lies within the calendar of end time events. It can most certainly be said that we are closer to the end than we were yesterday, and that tomorrow will be closer than we are today. Earlier we read a portion of Revelation 13, which also deals with those end time events. I'm confident that much, if not all, of that passage chronologically corresponds with the events in Matthew 24. Revelation 13, as you, I'm sure you heard, contains numerous symbolic references and imagery. It's the beast with the seven horns and or seven heads and ten horns, and you know, many of the other things are quite intriguing, I would say. We're not going to go down that road trying to figure that out. That can be left for the very daring or the very gifted. This morning I want to focus on a much simpler passage. One single verse, Matthew 24:12. "And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." Very simple. "And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." This has been brought to my heart by the Lord, I trust, in conjunction with the recent circumstances surrounding my mother's death, as well as other current events that are taking place in our day. As most of you know, my mother died on November 14th. And I want to fill you in a bit on, you know, some of the history leading up to that. It's going to take up a little time, but bear with me if you would. My mother was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 1996. She had three surgeries. One of them was for that original brain tumor, 96, and then she developed another tumor, and she had a surgery in 97, and then in 98, I believe, is when she had some scar tissue removed with another surgery. So they occurred between 3 years, 1996 and 1998. During that time, she also received a significant amount of radiation. And after that, between 1998 and about 2008, my mom lived a relatively self-sufficient life. Somewhere around 2008, she began to show progressive deterioration in her neurological functions. You know, her brain, that radiation had done damage, and the brain was starting to affect you know, different parts of her body, her all of her functions. Hospital visits became much more regular. She needed more and more help with walking and other everyday tasks. Around 2010, she really started to get much worse. She no longer could walk, even with help. She lost her sight, and her ability to communicate was significantly decreased, although she could communicate, right? When she got a cold or some other sickness that you or I would just kick, it basically threw her for a loop. When she got the cold, she wouldn't be able to drink. You know, she basically shut down. She had to go to the hospital to be hydrated. After a while, she would bounce back, though. Times were tough at home when she would come home. My dad took great care of her and my gram. But she would have many times where, you know, she had good times, too. We would call them good times for most people that aren't used to that type of condition, they would say it always looks bad. But she would have good times. She still enjoyed her company. She enjoyed her meals. And, you know, she had many good days. But sometimes they weren't so good days. I didn't know this till recently. In fact, when I was preparing the message, I verified with my dad. But according to him, when she had those hospital visits between 2008 and, you know, 10, the medical staff would often recommend hospice. I don't know if you guys are, I'm assuming most everyone knows what hospice is, but if not, hospice is a type of care that is intended to help people when they are near death to manage pain and, you know, just surround, ethically handle that type of situation. But they were recommending this, like I said, when she was going in for hospital visits, and she still had good function. If you sign up for hospice, you basically agree to forego any further treatment or hospital trips. In the summer of 2011, my mom had a hospital trip to Millard Fillmore Gates Circle, and I was more involved with that one. I stayed overnight there, etc. I specifically remember a young doctor approached my father and I, and he was, you know, very, very adamant. He really thought we should enroll her in hospice. It didn't set well with me at the time. I didn't understand why he was saying that. I mean, she looked bad, but she wasn't, you know, dying at that point. Because from what I understood about hospice, it was that for like I said earlier, for people who had terrible pain and were very near death, my mom was not there. The doctor mentioned this thing called quality of life. And maybe to him she looked that she didn't have any, but I knew my mother did have quality of life, you know, especially during the better days. Thankfully, he didn't persuade my father to sign my mom up for hospice, because after that she was almost home for a year and a half. Yes, with some tough times, but again, also with some good ones. Okay, it was during this year and a half time that I really was able to speak to my mother about Christ more. And I observed some things. She made some indications that I'm convinced that the Lord was gracious to her in that time period. My mom became ill during the week of October 14th. This is just last month. She went into the hospital October 19th. This time, almost from the beginning of her stay, the medical staff were pushing hard for hospice. She had pneumonia, and they said she would continue to get pneumonia due to aspiration, which is something about, you know, getting food or liquids down into your lungs. After a few days, though, the pneumonia cleared up. However, after 8 days, she had not had any food in the hospital. And at that point, from my thinking, I say to myself, after 8 days of no food, how do you know if, you know, if you're not getting better because you haven't had any nourishment whatsoever? At that point, we did urge them to put a feeding tube in, which they did. They put one in her nose. For about 2.5 to 3 days, she had some nourishment. There were a couple issues, though. She threw up twice. However, there was another thing. She had some blood because of the in her nose because of the irritation. So my thoughts were that, you know, this throwing up was not because she was rejecting the food, but because, you know, the irritation and the bleeding getting into her stomach. So I asked the doctor if we could remove this tube in the nose and get a more permanent tube called a PEG tube, which is one you put in the stomach. The doctor thought it was a reasonable proposition. This specific doctor, you know, when you're in the hospital, you don't normally see the same doctor all the time. It's you're seeing someone different all the time. So they pulled this tube out of her nose, and the doctor said, "Yeah, this is, you know, we'll get that moving. Try to get the PEG tube in there." However, it turns out that after that, none of the medical staff. I never saw that doctor again. For the rest of my mom's stay, none of the staff thought that they should give her artificial feeding. But I will admit, she did have a hard time swallowing. You know, she would not have been able to survive by oral feeding. Okay, she would have needed a feeding tube. However, like I said, they really did not want to do that. I did actually feed her some soft foods, and she tried to eat them. It was very difficult, but she did eat. She, you know, it seemed as if she wanted to eat. You know, was it just a reflex? I don't know. Another incident was a neurologist came in to talk with my dad and I again, and he started in on the topic, which we will discuss in a bit more, quality of life. Quality of life. I strongly reason with him that his idea of quality of life is his standard. And that to my mom, even being able to hear her grandkids or to hold her mother's hand represented a quality of life. So further efforts to persuade the medical personnel overseeing my mom's case were to no avail. They basically refused to put the feeding tube in, and they left no other option than hospice. I really was still convinced the approach was wrong. My mom's core organs seemed strong, you know, heart, lungs, all this other stuff. I mean, yes, she was having some respiratory issues, but it wasn't showing that, you know, they were filling with fluid or anything, etc. So my thought was, what's really going to kill her? What's going to kill my mom? From what I could see, what was going to wind up killing her was starvation and dehydration. On Thursday, November 8th, my mom was removed from IV fluids, and of course, she had no nourishment for about a week at that point. I was very troubled at this juncture, and I felt that something was seriously wrong, yes, morally wrong with the way this case was approached. But I felt there was really nowhere to turn. I mean, you feel a sense of loneliness there. The Lord did allow me, however, to find a resource on the web, and it's called this. It's called Stealth Euthanasia, Healthcare Tyranny in America, Hospice, Palliative Care, and Healthcare Reform. Now, this resource was written by a gentleman named Ron Panzer, who is a RN, and a very experienced consultant in the hospice field. He belongs to an organization called Hospice Patients Alliance. The book completely confirmed my suspicions that something seemed wrong. It discussed the reality of foundational changes that have and are slowly occurring in the medical field with respect to how life itself is viewed. Rather than holding a view which promotes the sanctity of life meaning a sacredness of life, period, many are adopting what's called the quality of life standard. Mr. Panzer states the following, and I quote, "You may be surprised today, many people have adopted the quality of life ethic, where it is okay to end someone's life because they are seriously, note seriously, disabled, very elderly, have dementia, or any number of other reasons. In a very real sense, many of us have become numb to the killings so that we accept an increasingly larger category of lives that may be ended in a medical setting. And many times we don't call them killings, we say, we let them go, it was time. And to let go is certainly appropriate when someone is truly at the end of life, but when someone is not imminently dying and they end up dead, it really is a medical killing." Brothers and sisters, this is a very dangerous outlook. It's dangerous to undermine and to undermine the sanctity of life and to take this quality of life approach. What basis do they use? Who determines what quality of life is? Whose standard? In another place in the book, Mr. Pander discusses a situation similar to my mother's, and I quote this. It says, "In an end-of-life care setting, the way that the provision of food and fluids is halted is quite simple. The patient is sedated, then food and fluids cannot be given orally. Misapplying terminal sedation of the patient makes the whole process of withholding food and liquids look peaceful to the family at the bedside. They tell the family members that the patient can't eat or drink before the patient really is unable to eat. So they accomplish the permission to terminally sedate and hydrate the patient and then impose death in this way. He says, I've regularly heard from families that say hospice staff sedated the patient and gave them food or water when they were lethargic, almost asleep, and when the patient coughed, had trouble swallowing, they say he can't take fluids by mouth. He has a swallowing problem. Then they make the patient NPO, which means you can't eat anything by mouth, and without fluids, the patient dehydrates. This could be done to anyone, including you or me. It is a prescription for death. And it's deceptive. This is not formal euthanasia or assisted suicide, but accomplishes death just as effectively. It is the most widely practiced form of euthanasia in America today, and is allowed by law enforcement, the district attorneys, and the courts. They have chosen not to get involved, so the killings continue." End quote. I'll mind you, my mom's situation wasn't the same. She, like I told you, she would have needed a feeding tube. Mr. Pander estimates that over 100,000 vulnerable patients may be hastened prematurely to their death through hospice or palliative care each year. I'm sure some of you older folks here remember a person named C. Everett Koop. Anybody? Nobody? C. Everett Koop? He was the highly respected Surgeon General. Don't you remember Surgeon General C. Everett Koop during the Ronald Reagan years? Okay. Hopefully he brought it back. I'm going to read you something he wrote. He was a very respected man. I mean, you heard his quotes all the time. Do you remember now, Mr. Bridell? Okay. All right. C. Everett Koop says, "We must be wary of those who are too willing to end lives of the elderly and the ill. If we ever decide that a poor quality of life justifies ending that life, we have taken a step down a slippery slope that places all of us in danger. There is a difference between allowing nature to take its course and actively assisting death. The call for euthanasia surfaces in our society periodically, as it is doing now under the guise of death with dignity or assisted suicide. Euthanasia is a concept, it seems to me, that is in direct conflict with a religious and ethical tradition in which the human race is presented with, a blessing and a curse, life and death. We are instructed, therefore, to choose life. I believe euthanasia lies outside the commonly held life-centered values of the West and cannot be allowed without incurring great social and personal tragedy. This is not merely an intellectual conundrum. This involves actual human beings at risk. While the terror of state-sponsored euthanasia may never grip America as it once did Germany, it is possible that the terror of euthanasia ethic tolerated by medicine and an indifferent public and is practiced by a few physicians may grip many invisible and vulnerable Americans. Over 50 years ago, German doctors and courts collaborated to identify millions of people who were labeled devoid of value. Some Americans are labeled the same today, members of a racial or ethnic underclass, a sidewalk screamer, an illegal alien, a nursing home resident with Alzheimer's, abandoned migrant worker, or anyone too old or weak or poor to help him or herself. For two millennia, the Hippocratic tradition stood for the sanctity of human life. We can alleviate the unbearable in life better than we ever could before. We can do that and not eliminate life itself. As I have said many times, medicine cannot be both our healer and our helper. C. Everett Koop. I know I'm taking a lot of time, but keep following if you could. On the morning of Wednesday, November 14th, my father and sister left the hospital to go home, get a shower, and bring back my aunt and my gram. While I was in the room alone with my mom, a palliative care doctor came in. After a bit of small talk, I pointed to my mom and I said to him, you know there's going to be a trial for my mom's case. There's going to be a trial. Someday there'll be a trial. And he was kind of puzzled at that, you know, statement. And then I explained to him the issue of judgment. I told him there's going to be a trial for every single case that the medical staff are, you know, making decisions on. I told him that, you know, I agreed there is a value to hospice and end-of-life care when it's solely for alleviating suffering of the dying patients. But I told him they need to be very careful and they're walking a very fine line between helping someone who is dying versus facilitating their death. And I said, especially because of the, I mean, categorically, and to put it in the context of because their judgment of quality of life, I said that's dangerous. That's very slippery, a slippery slope, basically. So I challenged him with the person of Christ after that, and he left. My mom died at 5:05 that night. Now, I want to say another thing. It is possible that my mom was truly going down the path of death. I don't know. But we don't know for certain if these, you know, the artificial or, you know, the tube feeding would have helped her and gave her a longer time. I don't know. Proverbs 30:14 reads this, and listen carefully. Says, there is a generation whose teeth are as swords and their jaw teeth as knives to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. Is this our generation? Friends, I know it took a long time, but I want you guys to beware of this topic. Most people, you don't have to deal with this day to day, but chances are very good that someday you will have to deal with it, whether it's with your parent, a relative, yourself, what have you. Keep that in the back of your mind. That's my first point. And the clock is ticking. I promise the others will not be as long. That issue was just the catalyst for the others I'm going to talk about. And it happened to be a very current issue personally for me. Back to our text, you're thinking, oh, he's not preaching about the Bible. Our text is Matthew 24:12. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Iniquity shall abound. Abounding, of course, means very prevalent. Matthew Henry, in his commentary on this, said that we can be sure that iniquity will always be in the world. In fact, we have remaining iniquity in ourselves. But the Lord's expression here denotes a time where there is abundantly more. It's going to happen. Is it happening now? Abounding iniquity. I just talked at length about this issue of stealth euthanasia, as coined by the reference material I told you. It's very possible you may have never heard about such a thing, so you might question the application of this text to what I just said. But the next topic I will briefly discuss, I know you are very familiar with. In fact, I would suggest you are all too familiar with it. In fact, probably comfortable with it. I would liken it to a big, ugly stump in your yard. At first, you desire and purpose to get it out of your yard. But as you procrastinate, you become used to the stump. It doesn't look so bad after all. In fact, you begin to hang bird feeders on it, outside thermometers. Eventually, you take a saw, cut a notch in it, and use it as a seat to sip tea. This very big, familiar, ugly stump I'm talking about is none other than evolutionary theory, otherwise known as Darwinism. In my mind, there's perhaps no heresy that rivals evolution and its success with infiltration of the Western society and perhaps the world. Evolution in its purest form completely denies that God is God. Evolution claims the universe is an accident. And life is an accident. It says that in the beginning, God did not create. It renders the scripture a fairy tale. Pure evolution does not account for sin or oppose the need for any type of gospel. It leaves us completely unaccountable. Evolutionary theory says what? Survival of the fittest. But even theistic evolution are people who say God, there is a God, he created, but he used evolution. There's different variations of that. But it says, it denies the scripture, first of all. It casts doubt on everything in the Word. It denies that death resulted from sin. Evolution, theistic evolution would have to say that evolution needs death for it to happen. It's not saying death happened because of sin. If death is not from sin, then there's, again, no need for Christ. Christ becomes superficial. Theistic evolution makes God a distant observer. It says he started things in emotion, but after that it was hands off. Denies his sovereign rule. It makes the creation more impressive than the Creator, since he only made a simple single-celled life form. Nature did the rest. You might think that, as a Christian, you can live quite comfortably with the prominence of evolution around you, right? After all, it's just a theory about the past. How does that hurt you? It's just talking about, what I believe happened back then, right? Before you answer that, I want to read you several paragraphs from a commentary of an article written by a Harold Brown in 1987, the periodical Human Life Review, and I quote, Brown notes that two major intellectual developments in the 19th century helped to pave the way for Hitler and the Nazis. One was the rise of the higher criticism movement, which championed liberal biblical scholarship, resulting in a full-scale attack on the authority and reliability of Scripture and a corresponding rejection of the supernatural. The other was the Darwinian philosophy of the survival of the fittest. As Brown notes, in Germany, it was but a short step from extolling the survival of the fittest as nature's mechanism for advancing the race to actually, or wait, it says here, attachment of the race to endorsing the elimination of the least fit. In other words, they jump from, you know, we're taking this philosophy, and now we're jumping to, well, we need to help that philosophy. We're gonna eliminate the least fit. We're gonna contribute to the human race's progression. Still in the article, it says, Darwin's system undermined the biblical doctrine of man being made in God's image, so that man was seen as the highest ranking primate yet to have climbed the evolutionary ladder. And Darwin's successors were quick to seize on the concepts that if survival of the fittest is natural and good, it is wise to promote it by eliminating the unfit. I'm diverting from that article now, just another piece of information that I looked up. The Nazis began a program in 1939 to euthanize disabled children. Now, these were German children. I'm not talking about Jews. German children. The program was expanded to include all adult disabled persons, all types of adult disabled persons. Historians estimate that 200,000 individuals perished due to this program. Of course, you know that the next step was the Jewish genocide. Now back to the article. Brown has a question. Why did most Christians, even conservative ones, succumb? In other words, to this program in Nazi Germany. A big factor was the prestige of modern science. The early 20th century veneration for science, particularly strong in Germany, extended even to the pseudoscience of racial hygiene or ethnic cleansing. And it led otherwise serious Christians to acquiesce in almost anything done in its name. That to a large degree explains why even the German euthanasia programs tended to be accepted by Christians. Faced with the double argument that such euthanasia was both scientific and legal, within the competence of the secular government, many Christians and Christian organizations simply submitted. Brown asks, how could so many dedicated Christians committed to giving loving care to physically and mentally handicapped people as they're calling from God acquiesce in the liquidation of the very people who they had been trustfully placed in their care? He continues, and I'm almost done with this quote. He continues, the fact that so many of these selfless workers went along with the spirit of the age, not only without protesting, but apparently without even understanding the implications, should stand as a sinister warning to Americans from the same Christian traditions, as we observe a similar moral impotence in our own midst. In other words, if we see that we're not affecting our generation, we need to be concerned about these matters. Are we affecting our generation? So as you can see, evolution is not such a good neighbor after all. The foundations that it builds in the hearts of the indoctrinated, those indoctrinated by it, often bring forth the fruit of disregard of life. And this can affect you in a very tangible way. So I talked about euthanasia. I talked about evolution. What else? Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. When was the last time you've had any thoughts about seeking the Lord about having Him deal a blow to evolution in our day? Good. There's some people that have done it. Are we encouraging our culture in this area? Are we doing anything about it whatsoever? I know there's some organizations, but I'm saying as a whole. Is there any victory? Is there any progress? Second point that was. Two more very quickly. Something else occurred during the time of my mother's hospital stay. Our country had an election for president. And as you know, Barack Obama won the presidency. Additionally, the Democratic Party and liberalism as a whole had a great election across the board. Ballot initiatives were approved, such as same-sex marriage being passed in Maine, Maryland, and Washington State. Colorado and Washington voted to legalize recreational marijuana use. Those are just 2 points. However, most profoundly, think of this. About a week before the election, Dr. John MacArthur, you know, the preacher in At Grace to You, he featured two powerful messages on abortion and homosexuality. And I highly recommend, if you haven't heard them, listen to them. In his messages, he stressed something very profound. He said it was the first time in American history that the platform of one of the major political parties was based on sin. The platform on which they ran. And if you happen to have watched or heard anything about the Democratic Convention, it was crystal clear that they were taking a stand on the right for women to kill their babies, abortion, and the right for homosexual marriage. That was a large part of the platform, a large part of the presentation. Dr. MacArthur was indicating how profound that was, and I agree. It used to be that generally Democrats, but not only Democrats, I'm not talking about politics here, I'm talking about those issues. Democrats or Republicans. It used to be that people who supported abortion heavily or homosexual marriage, it was behind the scenes. But now it's all on the table. And our culture and our nation gave it a thumbs up. Do you know that? It was a great election. A few more statistics and I'll be near to close. According to the Center for Disease Control, government agency, 50 million abortions have happened since 1973. Did you hear me right? 50 million. That averages out to about 1,250,000 a year. That's 3,424 every day, including Saturdays and Sundays. 3,424 helpless humans a day being killed. Do you know how many people were killed in the September 11th attacks, including all the events, the planes, the Pentagon, everything? 3,497 is what I read on the internet. So 3,497 September 11th. Every single day, averaged out, 3,424 humans a day. It makes news, doesn't it, when there is a gun-wielding murderer who kills a few people, right? But when 3,424 helpless babies are violently cut into pieces, you hear nothing. It has been stated, the information I saw, obviously I don't have my own data set, but 18 to 22% of all pregnancies in the United States end in abortion. 18 to 22%. That's staggering in my mind. I don't know what you guys expected, but to me I would have never guessed it was that high. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Is your love waxing cold? Is our love waxing cold? Is iniquity abounding? A recent poll indicates 51% of our nation now popular support, 51% support homosexual marriage. 8 states now recognize same-sex marriage the Supreme Court is now due to consider whether to hear cases on same-sex marriage. I mean, the rate things are going, I'm not going to be surprised at all if that topic is promoted is okay and it starts to become a national occurrence. There are some states that have banned it, but the federal that would wind up being a big battle where the federal government would impose that somehow under the Constitution. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. In closing, you might think that this message was preaching out of the front page, right? I would concede that maybe it was. But I want to suggest to you something, that we need to know how to engage our generation. We need to apply doctrine. We need to apply the doctrine we've been given. We need to know how to use it in our day. We need to understand the implications of not using it. To simply hold on to the doctrine, the truth, without engaging our culture, I think is a disservice and or maybe even a sin. Certainly we must learn the truth and guard the truth. I mean, we can't sit up here every week and talk about the newspaper. I agree. But I do think we need to be informed. And we need to, the Lord gave us this passage. I mean, we need to try to apply it somewhere. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. In the days of the Reformation, they met the challenge of the day, didn't they? By the grace of God. What was the challenge of the day? I don't think it wasn't the exact same. They were not the exact same challenges we are facing today. We do need to remember those battles. We need to remember how they fought, how they gained for us a lot of benefit. We need to keep guard for similar attacks. But there are different battles to fight today. I'm not saying there's something new under the sun, but the enemy isn't dumb. If we in this church are not being attacked by heresy, which, you know, we're not, and there's probably a lot of faithful churches that are not being attacked by heresy in the church, don't you think the enemy's smart? They know this, that, okay, all I've got to do is get iniquity abounding, and then what's going to happen? Your love's going to wax cold. You know why? Just like I told the kids. You have clothes on your floor. You're always around it. You don't even notice it anymore. Right? May God grant us that we might be people who affect our generation for Christ. And may we not be people who are affected, made cold by our generation. The Lord said, because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Notice the Lord says many, many. Thankfully not all. He doesn't say all. He says many. That's good. May it be that we are the few whose love does not wax cold. May you be one whose love doesn't wax cold. But we have to keep in our hearts, we have to know the sins of our day. We have to know, not know them experientially, we have to know what's going on. We have to keep in our hearts, you know, why is it, what is this sin? How is it dishonoring God? I mean, if we see evolution, and if you start to really grab hold of this is dishonoring my God, the one I love. This is dishonoring to Him. Then you'll maintain a love. Your love will start to stay warm. If you realize the value of life, that God made us in His image, you'll realize that demeaning that life and throwing it out, you know, killing 3,400 babies a day, or you know, letting people who are disabled be drugged to death without eating and drinking. You know, you're going to start to grow some more love. I mean, through prayer, of course. I'm not saying neglect other means. Look, take all the means that are available. Pray to the Lord. Take His warning here. I think in Mark, one of the other passages he talks about the end times, he says, "Behold, I have told you." I'm paraphrasing, but it's there. In other words, listen, these are serious things. We need to love not only God, but we need to love mankind. We need to tell our generation their sins. We need to engage them. We need to not only tell them their sins, we need to tell them about a Savior who came to save from those sins. And of course, we have to be praying about these things. We need to pray about all the things we've continued to pray about. But let's just start thinking about the iniquity that's abounding. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Another passage, the Lord says, "Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is henceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men." In the bulletin, it was good to see the final paragraph of the devotional applied to this. John Calvin says, "To engage with a wicked world while remaining separate from evildoers can be difficult, yet it must be done. We cannot abandon sinners in their plight, but we must ensure that their evil does not rub off on us. This requires constant prayer for wisdom and a heart and mind full of Christ and His Word." May God bless us.